Forgive me if I seem to preach, but there is something that I want to say, a message that I hope will reach people who are throwing life away. I call it my philosophy. That is why I pass it on to you, because it works so well for me and helps me get away from strife. I hope you listen carefully. They say the truth will make you free, and that's the way you want to be. Because, brother, this is your life. Long as you live in, always remember, time is for spending, but there's an ending. While you are sleeping, lifetime is creeping. Wake up and taste it, foolish to waste it. Sample and savor all of its flavor, long as you're living. Long as you're living, always remember, folks who are lazy are playing crazy. Better keep moving.
That's the great Abby Lincoln, Abinata Moseka, with Long As You're Living. It's from her 1959 album, Abby Is Blue, for the Riverside label. Tommy Turrentine on trumpet, brother Stanley Turrentine on tenor sax, Julian Priester on trombone, Bobby Boswell on bass, and Max Roach on drums. She was married to Max Roach from 1962 to 1970. Anna Marie Wooldridge, that was the name that she was given at birth, was a jazz vocalist, a songwriter, actress, and civil rights activist who wrote and performed her own compositions. She was a civil rights activist during the 1960s. She died on August the 14th, 2010, 3 years after undergoing open-heart surgery in New York City. She died 8 days after her 80th birthday. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is my birthday. A little one day late, we had the tech gods visiting their wrath upon me yesterday and interrupting a program, but I decided I would do it today, celebrating my first birthday. Yeah, I know. I am a geezer. Yes, I am. But I'm referring to the fact that I'm 1 year from a very critical moment in my life when, without warning, I was given a very dire diagnosis of fourth stage cancer and had to deal with that and was advised, I would say 1 day ago, last year, on April the 12th, by a doctor, the lead oncologist at the hospital, who said, go home and make yourself as comfortable as possible, meaning death was right at my door waiting for me to get there and probably would have beaten me at it. But, of course, I'm here, a full year away from that really disappointing and very jarring prognosis and diagnosis all at the same time. Well, how did this happen? My girlfriends and I, we had a thing of talking to each other in different parts of the country, connecting on Sunday mornings. And on this particular Sunday morning, I was in the process of cleaning up my house. I was late at it because I was delayed out of town on a project, and I didn't get to clean my house the way good Caribbean people are supposed to do as the new year was ushering itself in. So I was late on the whole business of house cleaning. The idea is that you're supposed to clean your house really, really, really clean, because how the new year meets you is how the rest of the year will treat you. That's the basic tenet of this whole house cleaning obsession in the Caribbean, certainly in Trinidad, where I was born and raised. And so I carry on the tradition, except that I was delayed at it. And it dawned on me that I had been working all through the night and early into the morning, and now it was mid-morning, and I hadn't even had a thing to eat. And not far from, in fact, walking distance from my house, is a Dunkin' Donuts. And I said, okay, this is the day that I'm going to have some Dunkin' Donuts coffee. So I went down to Dunkin'. Just don't tell Gary, okay? Just don't tell him I went to Dunkin' Donuts. But really, Dunkin' Donuts saved my life. I went down to Dunkin' Donuts and had some coffee and started this group discussion that our group has, catching up on things. And I felt so awful. Suddenly, this overwhelming feeling of just awfulness overcame me. It felt the way I felt when I had the Hong Kong flu. Just awful. Sweating profusely and feeling jittery and just incredible nausea. I had to run to the bathroom and throw up a couple of times. I really thought to myself that I had had some kind of really bad coffee and something tainted. And I went to the manager and I said, look, I just had some coffee. I had a croissant with it. And I'm so sick. I just wonder whether, you know, I have a touch of food poisoning here. And I just want to tell you, in the event that you might want to go back there to the kitchen preparation area and just check it, because I'm really, really, really sick. And he was such a kind person. He said, okay, I'm so sorry that you're feeling badly. Why don't you sit down? I'll get you a glass with some water and lemon juice squeezed in it, and maybe that would help. I said, okay. But it didn't go away, this feeling. And then he said, look, you're not looking so good. Maybe I should call 911. I said, no, not yet. But I'll try and find my way home. Home was just about a block, less than a block away. And would you believe I couldn't walk home? I just couldn't make it. I actually had to call a cab to take me less than a block away. And once I got home, I just flew into the bed thinking, I'm coming down with a really bad flu of some sort, something, and I'll just rest it off. And then, you know, I woke up shortly after I lay down, within a half an hour, and the bed was drenched with sweat. Everything I had on was drenched in sweat. And I knew this was really, really, really bad. This was just not good at all. And I did call 911, and they came and got me and took me to the emergency room. And right there, they conducted a bunch of tests. They found that my heart was just racing, and apparently racing toward a heart attack of some sort, some heart event I was going to be having, because my heart was racing. And I still continued to feel so really bad. And then a doctor came and said to me, well, how long have you been smoking? I said, I've never smoked in my life. I don't smoke. He said, well, I hate to tell you, but we're seeing cancer in your lungs. You have cancer in the lungs. And from there began a journey, literally, into myself, confronting an awful diagnosis. And that was yet to come. It was one thing to be told I had cancer, and a whole other thing to be told that it was stage 4, which is end stage cancer. And you may recall last year I did the program right from my hospital bed, and I shared the news with you. I told you what was going on with me. But I was really trying to adjust to this reality that I had a very serious disease and it was in charge. I no longer was in charge of me. This thing, this invisible thing, was. And for the days that I remained in the hospital undergoing all kinds of tests to determine the severity of the disease, and they determined it was stage four. I mean, I had just been diagnosed and given a death sentence all at the same time. And I had to wrap my head around that. And I did. And the first thing I could think of doing was calling Gary Null, who I'd known for more than 30 years. I called him and I said, you know, Gary, this is my situation. I'm calling you from the hospital. And I just received a diagnosis of fourth stage cancer. Cancer in the lungs. And I need help. And he said to me, come right away. I had been sitting there in the hospital bed, and basically every day, different kinds of tests, biopsies of the lungs going in a couple of times, you know, all kinds of indelicate things being done to determine just where this massive cancer was and to what degree it had invaded my body. And then I said to the doctors and to the nurses taking care of me, is there a medical necessity for me to be here? And they looked at each other and they said, well, no. I said, good. I'll be leaving today then. I called a friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine, and said, look, I need you to come pick me up because, and I told him the story. He came and picked me up and took me directly to Gary. And I got there about 4:15 and I met a team waiting there for me. And they began immediately to work on me. And I must tell you that Gary made his entire apparatus of healing available to me as he did make himself personally available to me in all of that time. And he came up with a protocol that would improve my chances of living. There's no delusion on my part that there is some cure for what I have. There is no cure. I'm very clear about that. If it does happen, it would be great, but I'm not expecting it to happen. I'm a realist. But I do appreciate the fact that all efforts had been directed toward making my life continue to be livable as fully as I wanted to be. And that also put me in a moment of arresting myself and dealing with myself and the finality of things. I had to deal with the fact that I had never really placed my health at the top of any list at all. I had placed my work, I had placed other people's well-being and other people's prosperity and their comfort and everything at the top of my list. I was just nowhere on a list of priorities for all these years. I mean, I've worked like a demon. 11 people were hired to replace me when I left my job. 11 people full time, and they couldn't do what I used to do by myself. That's the ferocity with which I worked, the single-mindedness and the energy I gave to work. But really no thought at all about my health and how important it was to maintain good health. And there, smack right there in the moment, I found myself having to deal with this issue. And I said, okay, let's get this thing going. Oddly enough, and I really am telling you the truth here, I never despaired. And I still don't. I did not see myself in the throes of death. Although it is very, very possible that I could soon die, I accept that. But I am beyond that. I've always been fixed on living well, living fully. And that has not changed at all. In fact, I think that is what has carried me through this idea that it is enough to want to live fully and to actually feel that you're doing just that. That is great. That is enough. You know, all those things, those big things that many people want in life. They want, you know, the yacht. They want the aeroplane, and they want the fancy cars and mansions in 20 major cities. None of those things has ever held a great appeal to me. I like the idea of feeling contented in the moment. I like the idea of feeling good about what I do and about connecting with people in a genuine way. It's always been my thing. And I tell you, I got that from my parents, directly from my parents, Claude and Gertrude, two extraordinary, ordinary people. My father was a very extraordinary man, but never really loomed large in his extraordinariness. Other people did that. He didn't. He was gregarious. He was a boisterous man. He was a dedicated man. He's not at all perfect. But in the ways that a man should be perfect, he came pretty close to perfect. He was, to me, as perfect a father as you can ask for. His whole life was his children and his family, and being of service to others. His whole life was about that. And he was a very happy man, a very contented man. And people gravitated toward him like bees to honey. I mean, they just were. And he was just like that. He was a big, wholehearted man. My mother, on the other hand, was a kind of polar opposite. She was very demure, very quiet, very reserved, very proper, very much concerned with doing things the right way. She never raised her voice, and she never, you know, ranted and had fits of rage and anger at all. She was just very firm and single-minded, as my dad was. They were one in this regard, single-minded about seeing to the futures of their children. 9 miserable children. 7 boys. Yes, there are 7 of the male species that I grew up with, and 1 sister who, unlike me, is just angelic. people used to say all the time, you're not like your sister. And I would say, yes, and don't you forget it. My sister was very, very much like my mother in her personality, very quiet, very unassuming, very polite. I ate none of them things. Well, anyway, so we grew up in a household with parents who were true to the colonial experience in that sense. They knew that the future for their children required them to get things together fast so that they can get out of the house and get out of the country real fast and go someplace and acquire a future. There was no future to be had in my country at the time, which was a colony of Britain. At least that was its latest transformation. Just about every European power had its claws into my little country, Trinidad and Tobago, a little bit of dust in the Caribbean Sea. But that little piece of rock and pieces of rock like Barbados and Grenada and St. Lucia and St. Kitts and Antigua and Martinique and these small islands created the British Empire. It came at a great cost. My grandmother, my father's mother, literally was the last of her group. She was a Carib woman. On my mother's side, the people are from Africa direct and Irish. Yeah, this is a beautiful thing about the Caribbean. Nobody is pure or anything. At my niece's wedding years ago, this was in Florida, the photographer said, okay, time for the leads. And we all got up. And he kept saying, no, just the leads, just the leads. And he said, we are just the leads. Well, he saw people who looked Pakistani because they were. He saw Muslims because they are. He saw Chinese people because they are. We're all related. That's the way it is in the Caribbean. But I come back to this question about being raised in a household where the number one priority was education and the pursuit of knowledge and really surviving a rather odd process that my father instituted in our household called constitutional talks. Well, those were really scary experiences because he would line us up in the living room with our book bags in front of us and he would lock the door to lock my mother out because she would from time to time interrupt these torture sessions with pleas and with entreaties. Claude, please let the children go to sleep. He didn't want to hear any of that. And your life came to an end, usually on a Saturday night, when he is interrogating us one by one about our performance in school for the week. We have no idea to this day how he found out what we did in school all week. But he kept tabs. And although my mother, demure as she was and quiet as she was a recognized ruler of our roost, including of the big boisterous Claude Lead, my father took over on Saturday nights. He was the boss. And he would be there for hours being quizzed about things that he thought we ought to know. What is igneous rock, he would say. Give me 6 months, I'm sure I could tell you. But right now, the answer seems to have escaped me. There was no such thing. You just had to know. Because, like a good West Indian head of household, I am the one providing a house for you. I put a roof over your head. I put food in your stomach. I put clothes on your back. All you have to do is do well in school. And you're telling me now, I'm asking you about igneous rock, and you have no idea what that is. Well, I mean, that's very shameful. You had to know what igneous rock is, because it's there in the textbook he bought you. You're supposed to know. Well, all of this comes back to this question, believe it or not, of having cancer. I know, it sounds disconnected, but it actually is. Because I had to lean very heavily on the lessons taught me as a child to pull me through, to give me an orientation. I had to emulate the behaviors of my parents, who, in the face of adversity, were solid rocks. My mother, I mean, like all the women we knew growing up in our little village, these women who had 21 and 22 children, who had no problem, they managed that like tried and true generals. They ruled without being outrageous and obnoxious. And they took care of each other's children. They saw to it that no one went unclothed or unfed or uncared for. And the men knew exactly what they were supposed to do. That is, to secure the family, to defend the family, to take care of your children, to see to it that you guide them the right way. And it involved a lot of tumult and a lot of chaos sometimes. But it was always about putting your mind in a place where you can see yourself coming through. Eventually you will. And you had to develop that kind of mindset to tackle any adversity in life. You had to toughen up. And so I had to call upon that energy and toughen up. And although I was, of course, the direct beneficiary of a body of knowledge and experience in the field of alternative health to help me through, and that's, I thank Gary for that, I still had to do this work alone. I had to walk this path alone. I still have to do it by myself. There's nobody else who can do this for me. I have to do it. And this is the parallel that I bring to you today. The parallel being, life is like that. Life gives us, when we least expect it, sometimes the most incredible challenges. And yet, we have to find some way of believing that we are made of very tough stuff and we can cope with it. There are no promises in life. There's nothing sure except it will end somehow, someday. So what do you do with life while you have it? How do you live? What is life supposed to mean? What are you supposed to be doing with it? What do you make of it? That's a tough question. It sounds simple, but it actually is a tough question. I am grateful that even though I'm in a pretty tough bind, health-wise, I feel pretty good. I really do. I feel pretty good that I have a focus. I have something that reinforces my thinking about myself and what I'm supposed to be doing or what I'm supposed to have been doing with my life to this point. I feel pretty good about that. I like my work. I like people. I like being of service to the community. I really like it, and I see it as that's what I'm supposed to be doing. I feel that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. So that, for me, is a great reward, and it actually reinforces me to say, whenever life ends, whenever that may be, because it will. It will end for all of us. If you're listening to this, it will end for you too someday. But while you have the opportunity, why not just follow a path into yourself and say, really, what am I here for? What am I supposed to be doing? How am I supposed to be living? Of what use is this thing called life to me? My father, during these torture sessions, constitutional talks, he would call them. I don't know why he called them that. I mean, we never talked about any constitution. In fact, we were not allowed to talk at all. But that's what he called them. But in these life lessons, he would pose what would be philosophical questions. And they would be in the order of, you know, what is to be your statement in life, he would say. What is to be your statement in life? I don't know. I'm 6 years old. I don't even know how to spell statement. What are you talking about? But what is to be your statement in life, he would say. And that's what you're supposed to think about all the time. What is to be your statement in life? Everybody here on this planet will make a statement, even if people don't think so. But they have a statement to make in life. And the statement, supposedly, this is Claude Leed's philosophy I'm sharing with you. The statement is to be the embodiment of the best traits that you have, the best of yourself. And those things, these assets, these incredible assets, the statement you make is to what degree they helped other people. Yeah? So it's not really your property. It is in your possession, but it is not your possession. These things are supposed to be of use to your world, the world in which you live. And that creates community. You hear me talking about it all the time. Community is so important. You create community by sharing the best of who you are. And the best of who you are comes after you've been through test after test, and after you have located that part of yourself that is absolutely indomitable. Nothing would scare you. You're good. Now, you may be shaking in your boots. You'd be crazy if you look at some challenges and you ain't scared, then that means you're crazy. But you would have arrived, hopefully, at some point in your life where you're not scared. You're not at all dissuaded by the enormity of the challenge that you have. You can deal with it. I found myself arriving at a place of extraordinary calmness, to the point where nobody believed that I had cancer. There's many people still don't believe it. My doctors don't believe it. They look at me. I went into the cancer center not too long ago, and I was in the reception area waiting for my turn, and I sat next to a lady, and she didn't look so good. She really looked like she was in pain. And this was a specialist I was seeing. And finally, my turn came, and I went in, and he says, "So where's the lady that you were with?" I said, I don't know. I wasn't with anybody. He says, "Are you with Miss Lead?" I said, "No, I am Miss Lead." He said, "You are the cancer patient?" I said, "Yes." He said, "You don't look like a cancer patient." I said, "I don't feel like one. I don't. And yet I'm very, very ill, I'm sure. Every clinician would tell me. But I just don't feel that. So I don't act like that. And I don't see myself like that at all. I have arrived at a place where it's just one of the challenges that I will have to deal with before I go. And I aim to dispatch it with, you know, some degree of grace. It will solve that problem before I go." And that's what I'm asking you today, to think about arriving at a place where you're not afraid to live. So many of us, I think, have actually died, or we die long before we actually physically die. We are dead people. We just refuse to lay down. We won't lay down, but we really are dead people, because the things that really should drive us, the things that we should really want to acquire, is that sense of self, a really clearly defined sense of self. I don't know how you get that in the esoteric discussions that go along with that. I'm not into that. All I know is this. At some point, you have to realize that all you've got really is you in the end. There's no infinity here. You have a finite amount of time, a finite amount of energy, a finite amount of skills, a finite amount of friends, a finite circle of influence. Everything is quite finite. So to even contemplate things that take us into the realm of infinity is itself self-defeating. So deal with the finiteness of our existence. We're here for a short time. Why not really do something before you go? And improve yourself and make yourself useful to other people. How about that? Pretty good idea. Nothing complicated. But be true to yourself. And try to the best of your ability to make a positive contribution as often as you possibly can do that, as often as you could manage it. We live in a world today where there is such selfishness. I mean, it is amazing when you see how people behave. I used to run a journalism training program. It was rated the best journalism training program in the state of New York. And lots of people used to come in to observe this program because they heard about it. And then I would study their faces as they came into the program, into the physical space. And invariably, it would be the same. People would walk in and be completely underwhelmed. Underwhelmed. Major underwhelming happening the minute they step foot in there. they were expecting to see, you know, all the gadgetry that goes along with journalism. You know, they were expecting all of the frou-frou, all of the bells and whistles, and we didn't have any of that. I did not want any of that, because that's not what journalism is. That's learning to write doesn't require all of that. So they walked into one big room. That's it. It was a big room with some little desks. And on those desks were Royal Manual typewriters. Yes, 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 I know. But that's what all our budget would allow. Some manual typewriters, Royal classic, you have to have class here. So we had classic Royal Manual typewriters. You know, the ones with the ribbon. That's what we had. And I studied the faces of people looking at that classroom, set up the way it was. We all cramped into the same place. And that's where we did our work. But the expressions on their faces told me where they were in the scheme of things. They walked in with a completely different point of view of as to what was important. Was it important to have all the doodads and the bells and whistles? Or was it important to learn how to do this thing called journalism? I will tell you that out of that little hovel came some very, very good journalists. You see them on CNN, you see them in the New York Times and whatnot. My hope really was to train the next generation of people who would take up the helm of journalism at non-mainstream media, community-based media, black media, Latino media, and become the voice truly of the voiceless. We got some, but most people wanted to go into corporate life. Okay, but I tell you the story to tell you this. Very few of the people going through the program actually understood its worth at the time they were going through the program. Very few. And it was because they came into the process believing that it ought to be something else, that it had to do with all of the trimmings and all of the decorations and all of, and not the hard work of thinking and writing well and being forced to develop the skill of reporting, being exacting about commas and grammar and punctuation and all of that, and teaching you how possible it is. The premise was very simple. In 20 weeks, if you give me your undivided attention, no matter where you started in life, if you give me your undivided attention and all of your effort, in 20 weeks, I can definitely make you a very competent journalist. That was the bet. The program was very successful. And what made it successful? I never told anybody. We had professors coming from all over the country to observe this program because they heard about it. We were very unorthodox in our approach. I wrote the curriculum, and we had a very different approach to teaching. And I will share with you the answer. The big mystery being solved right now, the success of the program had to do with the fact that it's probably one of the most brilliant things I ever did in my life.
I hired a full-time psychotherapist. Yes. Now, he said, what does that have to do with journalism? It had everything to do with the success of the program. Because I knew people would be coming in there self-programmed for failure, unable to see their own capacity for success. They would be self-sabotaging, walking right in the door with a big problem that says, I can't succeed at this at all. This is a crazy proposition, and I know I'm going to fail. My job, as I saw it, was to turn up the heat, make you work, work you like a mule, like a team of mules. And the psychotherapist's job was to hold your hand and you're going to make it. But, you know, out of the program, they succeeded. But they would not have, it would not have been as successful had we not understood the importance of the psychological orientation that a person carries with him or herself all day, every day. If you don't see yourself as being perfectly fine as you are, as having the metal, just as you are, you've got it. You just need to refine here and tweak over there. And learn this skill over there and prepare yourself in a strategic way. And it could be done. But you have to come to terms with yourself and that part of yourself that makes you totally at peace with yourself. So at peace that nothing poses a major problem and an impossibility to you. That's what I strive for. I still am working at it, but I think I'm well on the way, because this cancer has just not done any damage to that part of myself, which I believe is my living self. I live as long as that part of me exists. And when I'm done, I'm done. Move on to the next assignment. But for the time being, that's what is important to me. All of my life, that very thing is important to me. Now, I don't know what this means to you, and I don't know why I'm going down this road, but I thought I would share that with you. I don't expect that, you know, there's some great lesson and I'm somehow a great philosopher suddenly casting these pearls of wisdom before you. But I'm saying, when all is said and done, you do know to your own heart, your own self, you do know that you're made of something quite divine, quite unusual, quite unique. You should want to embrace that. You should want to discover it, and once discovered, you want to hold on to it. Because that is what is going to keep you alive. That is to be the focal point of what my father would tell us, is to be your statement in life. Being at peace with that. Being at peace with how incredibly brilliant you are. How generous and kind. How thoughtful. How intuitive. How caring. These are the things that bring that complete defense mechanism to bear, where you can take on anything without fear, without trepidation. I'm going. Rather than say, first of all, how tough it's going to be, and why the 400 million ways you know you can't succeed at something. It is really coming to terms with that part of yourself and saying, okay, I'm good. So people could sing this song, or they could sing that song, or they can preach, talk Paul and preach Saul. Nothing really will rattle you. They can't preach false messages to you because you know intuitively whether it's in sync with that divine part of yourself. If not, you just say, okay, thanks for the info, but I really must be leaving. I have other things to do. And you keep on going on with your life. Don't waste any time with people who can't be helped. It's their job. That's their job, to discover that for themselves. When I come to this program every day, I have no idea how these programs will resonate with people. And frankly, I am just the same, very confident that something would happen for somebody in the course of a program. They will learn something. They will discover something new. If that happens, it means I've done my job. I'm good until tomorrow. And that's my job. So I have come to terms with the fact of what it is I'm here for, what it is I'm supposed to be doing, and I feel reasonably sure that we're in sync. I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I have taken up my charge. And I'm okay in that department, which means in my head, no matter what ravages my body, I'm okay. I'm fine. I'm happy and contented because I'm doing, to my mind, what I'm supposed to do. I encourage you to go through the same process. What are you here to do? You're here to do something, and something great. And I don't mean great in the, you know, Busby Berkeley sense of great, Hollywood great. I'm talking about sometimes it's something very small, but it's great. Very, very significant that you're doing that really impacts a life in a very positive way. So, it is my first birthday, and I am so happy to be here, I can't even tell you. I thank everyone for your prayers and your kind thoughts and your generosity of spirit, your wonderful words and your wonderful camaraderie. I lean on them every day, and I thank you for choosing me to give these gifts to. I'm very lucky. And that, too, is part of my contentment. So, when I say to you, it is a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, please know that I mean every single word of that. It is indeed a pleasure. It is indeed, for me, a great privilege to be in your company. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we have a great program. You want to stay tuned for it. Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can reach me at Lead Stories, that's LEID Stories, @gmail.com. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. Tell me a thing or two. Okay, we'll see each other tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining me today. Bye-bye.
After you're buried, live every minute. Put yourself in it, long as you're living. Long as you're living, always remember you're you'll never beat life. Don't try to cheat life. All men are brothers, do unto others. Love's for enjoying, hate's for destroying. Never forget it, or you'll regret it. Long as you're living. Forgive me if I seem to preach, but there was something that I had to say.